So chapter 8 is the perfection of contemplation, meditation, contemplative absorption. And this is quite a long chapter. And Chantidevi doesn't give detailed instructions on how to meditate, you know, how to do the mindfulness of breathing, how to do the metta-bhavana, how to do this, how to do that. He focuses on, he makes a distinction between samatha and vipassana, that we need to have the calm, stabilizing base of positive emotions in order to develop insight. We need a balance. And then he talks about, to start off with, that we need, in order to develop that stability, that dhyana, samatha, we need to leave the world. So that's a big part of the first part of the chapter, isn't it? So we need viveka, viveka ja. We need to be born of seclusion. We need viveka to be free from distraction and hindrances. And interestingly enough, especially desire, which we'll come on to again in a minute. So first of all, some of those verses you can categorise in terms of, he talks about isolation of the body. So leaving things behind. And he talks about leaving behind loved ones, foolish companions, things, competitiveness with others, and fame, praise and blame, you know, that all that kind of. So yes, isolation of the body, leaving the world, false refuges, I suppose, being involved with false refuges, so that you go away, you simplify your life, you're not distracted, because if you're distracted, you can't concentrate, and then you can concentrate and you know, get into your meditation practice. So we know that from our own, you know, going on retreat, going on solitary, we know that, you know, it's very different, isn't it, being away on your own, being on retreat, you know, a silent retreat, you know, your mind works in a different kind of way and it starts to settle down and calm down. I'm sure there's things to talk about in leaving those things behind, you know, loved ones. Does that mean we have to have no relationships whatsoever in any sense? Foolish companions, you know, those are companions who are going to lead us astray, but not spiritual friends, and so on. And then he does go into meditating in the cremation ground again. let's find a verse on that. Oh, this is, yeah, there are the verses in here, aren't there, about as a result of non-virtue, my skin will be ripped off by the henchmen of Yama. So that's in this chapter. So again, you have to think about how your group is going to respond to that or not. I can't find the cremation ground. Lost it. I'm talking about meditation. I'm in the wrong chapter, that's why. It's late at night for me. what verse am I trying to find? 29. A practice for isolation of the body is to meditate on the impermanence of the body, and he suggests going to the cremation ground and meditating. I suppose it's a decomposition of the corpse. Meditation, verse 29 onwards. So again, I mean, people will have responses and reactions to that. It's a meditation on death, I suppose, really. And I suppose we have to ask ourselves, does that work for us? If we want, again, to break attachment to the body, what, you know, how does that best work for us? Is it just we just do a death impermanence meditation, like the second of the four mind tones? We just reflect that we'll die, we're going to die, without going into all the gory details of a cremation ground reflection, or, you know, or do we want to go and do a cremation ground reflection, or imagine the decomposition of the corpse? I suppose we have to know ourselves, because Bhante in the commentary says that these kind of reflections on death, on impermanence, on the decomposition of the corpse, their effect should be one of invigoration, inspiration. I mean, that's how you should feel, not despairing and suicidal and despondent. So, you know, there's that story of the Buddha, isn't there, giving a meditation on death to some monks who did kill themselves. They weren't, you know, they weren't ready for it, and you know, he modified his teaching practices. So we have to know ourselves, or ask our friends, you know. So I'm going to go off and do a decomposition of the corpse meditation. Your friend might say, oh, I don't think it's a good idea. You know, how about just thinking you're going to die one day? That could be enough. It's you want to know what effect you want, don't you, rather than... It's just a method. So what method suits you? So any kind of reflection on decomposition or the unpleasant nature of the body and so on and so forth, the Ashubha Bhavana, it's a very strong medicine for a very strong desire. That's its methodology. So you have to know what type of person you are.
Is it a stronger meditation than a meditation or an attachment to the body? It's funny, I find it funny to think of it as stronger than that.
Well, I suppose it's. What do you mean by
in terms of, you know, like the idea of ultimately of eventually dying?
Dying
seems
yeah.
to me to have the potential for less impact than on our appearance changes if we value our appearance. That sort of thing. I'm just aware of that more in myself and others.
So that's stronger than kind of, you know, looking into the body and all its innards and so on. Is that what you're saying?
Well, to me, it seems that
stronger.
Way. I mean, that might be completely wrong for other people, maybe not.
I suppose if that works for you and that really does start to work against attachment, that's working for you, isn't it? And how would you feel about doing a meditation that, you know, you imagined you kind of cutting your body open and looking at your entrails?
And I mean, it's got a certain fascination for me. I don't find it difficult.
You don't find it repulsive, it doesn't upset you.
No.
Well, that's good. I suppose if you're meditating on you know, that I'm going to die one day, I mean, I think that has a very strong effect. This is more on the sort of loathsomeness of the body, isn't it? So that may have a not good psychological effect on some people, thinking of the body in that sort of way. I mean, I've got a scientific background, so I've done dissection in my past, you know, and so on. So it's not unfamiliar to see the insides of a body, you know, not a human body, but an animal body. So, but some people, it might be a real shock to go to a cremation ground or even imagine it, but others not. But I suppose you don't want to psychologically generate a kind of feeling of disgust in the wrong sort of way with one's body. You're trying to just be less attached.
I was just thinking about the different cultures, because, you know, in India, death's all around. You know, bodies parade through the streets, you go to the Ghats or whatever, and see. It's only been the spray, really, you know, so, you know, when I went to the Ghats, first of all, it was a bit like, I felt a bit distance from it, but actually at one point, because it's all to do with memory and hope, much wood you've got to burn, and you know, quickly, how much time you've got. You've got slots, somebody turning the body, and my just so really clearly and outlined the woman, you know, and I just thought, oh yeah, that was a person, you know, and then that leads me into thinking, yeah, that could be, you know, that would be me, actually.
Mm. So that's, I say, from the body, he goes a little bit into that, and then he talks about the joys of a solitary life and how free and happy that is. And then he goes into sections from verse 39, isolation of the mind, and dealing quite directly with attachment. I suppose it's quite interesting in that we were talking about anger and hatred being the strongest poison, as it were, for a bodhisattva, and that craving was okay, as it were. You got to choose. But in a way, he's really kind of going for attachment, desire, craving, lust in this section. And there's a note in another book I read that says, well, we experience that very frequently, some kind of level of attachment, desire, and we experience hatred rather rarely, which I thought was quite interesting. We experience craving, attachment, a lot of the time, desire. You know, we want things to be this way and that way, and we don't want this, we want that, and we like this, and we fantasize about that. But experiencing hatred is probably quite rare. So I thought that was quite interesting. You know, our minds are taken up a lot of the time with some sort of level of desire, and that's, you know, that is distracting our mind, taking our mind into the surface, and we're not concentrating. So he's really trying to work against that tendency in this, the first part of this chapter. And you know, then he gets, there's a lot on that, isn't there, from verse 40 on, and he's working particularly with sexual desire, perhaps the strongest kind of desire, sexual lust, and particularly it's framed in the desire of a man for a woman. So that usually in study brings up responses. If it's a woman's study group, I don't know what it's like in a men's study group, but, you know, the sense that, oh, it's the woman's body that's seen as disgusting and loathsome and the problem and the cause of craving, and, you know, that will, if you're studying this, that will arise, probably. So, you know, how are you going to work with that? I mean, we know Shantideva was a monk and he was in a monastic situation. In a different seminar, and I think it was a men's seminar, again, this kind of a Shubha Bhavana was part of the text, and it was about the loathsomeness of the female body, etc., etc. You know, when you really look into it, it's the same for all bodies, actually. And the man order member says, oh, would this work for women? You know, and Bhante says, well, why not? You know, it's craving or lust that's the issue. And if you're talking to women, then surely, you know, you want them to kind of not be attached, you know, not have lust and desire and all that comes from that. Wouldn't you talk in the same sort of way? But then he says, maybe. You know, what is it that women want from men? And he said, well, you know, sometimes it's that, you know, you want someone to rely on, you want someone to depend on, you want security. Maybe that, you know, that's what you would need to challenge. And then the man would have been saying, But well, you know, we can give that, can't we? It's so interesting that, you know, whereas women don't want the body thing to be focused on them, you know, obviously these guys didn't want to be thought that they couldn't be reliable or dependable. And Bhante's saying, no, you'll let them down. But we are order members, yeah, well, even worse. It's a very delightful little section of study and discussion. So maybe you have, you know, maybe that's something to think about. You know, if you're trying to let go of, you know, intense attachment, what is it that one's attached to? Is it the same for men and women?
I think it's a very good point that Bhante is making, but I would have thought it's incredibly difficult in our culture where, you know, even if one's chosen to be celibate, one doesn't necessarily criticise the ideal of, you know, a relationship. Whereas really he's suggesting that a relationship will interfere with.
Yeah, and, well, lust and craving and all that goes with that, yeah. Relationship. Yeah, he's a monk, isn't he? He wants you to go off into the forest and live in the forest. So, yeah, what are we going to do with that? You know, we're not going to do that. We're not a monastic order. So, you know, there's lots of questions, I think. Sorry?
It's probably not even aimed at women.
No.
It wouldn't be.
no.
But it feels like it's a bit of a different situation. They're two different things to me. One is the kind of looking at the kind of disgust of the body.
Yeah.
If that's how you want to put it.
Yeah. Your own body, say, or going
or
to a cremation ground.
Just bodies.
Yeah.
Generally. You know, and passing blood and whatever, you know, and going to the cremation ground and doing your decomposition of the body meditation.
Yeah.
Which is going to be the same for men and women.
Yeah.
And then sort of
breaking
sexual
craving.
Sexual craving.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they just seem to be.
Yeah.
I know they're connected, but they just do seem to be talking about two different things to me.
But I think both those sections in this chapter will provoke something. Something. And again, I suppose one needs to, you know, look at it in the whole context of the positive aspects of the body that Shantideva also expresses. And I suppose we have to think, what do we feel about renunciation? Do we feel, you know, how important is renunciation as a basis for developing bodhicitta? We're trying to love everyone equally, aren't we? So that's where attachment, very strong attachment, you know, can be a act against that. And yet, you know, we want relationships and we want friendships. So. So there's a lot of verses on that. And then having kind of talked about, you know, the cave and forest mind, having talked about seclusion, having talked about isolation of the body, isolation of the mind in order to develop calm and also to kind of break attachment, then he goes into the Mahayana meditation of exchanging self and other. So one precedes the other, you know, they're obviously seen as important together. The exchange of self and other. So just to go back to the Ashubha Bhavana, I just got a quote from Bhante from the seminar where he says it's usually given for people with very strong craving. And I think this is in Matic's own introduction. Sorry, it's very hard to talk against the wind. That the text stresses the alleged loathsomeness of our physical nature. You can wait for it to stop. Or I'll shout. Generally, it's reserved in its most complete form for the special type of personality which may find it beneficial. So the Ashubha Bhavana stresses the alleged loathsomeness of our body, physical nature, and generally it's reserved in its most complete form for the special type of personality which may find it most beneficial, i.e. somebody with very strong craving. And Bhante says that has many qualifications and they're all rightly emphasised. So as a practice, it should lead to exhilaration, inspiration, be invigorating and not lead to depression. So estimate how much you can take. Perhaps you have a bit of bone or a skull on your shrine. And it's not a philosophy of life, it's a method. So it's just worth remembering that for your... It's not a philosophy of life that the body is loathsome per se. That's not what it is, it's a method. So then he moves on to exchange of self and other. And the Mahayana meditation of exchange of self and other, the equality of self and other. And this involves lots of reflections, imagination, all kinds of scenarios that Shantideva kind of puts us or him through. You know, you imagine yourself as the other person in a dialogue. So you imagine yourself as an inferior person and how that would feel. And you imagine yourself how you'd feel if you were a rival in relationship to yourself, and how you would feel if you were superior. So he goes through all those kind of examples of trying to get you to stand in someone else's shoes in order to overcome focus on yourself and to see, you know, the interdependence of all beings, the equality of all beings. It's quite complex, I suppose, some of that. It's a wonderful idea, the exchange of self and other. Some of those arguments, you think, does that really work? Or maybe you have to really, really work at them for a while and see if they do work. I suppose with us, you know, we do the bodhicitta practice and we do the tonglen practice. We take a very practical way of exchanging self and other, exchanging the pain and the suffering, standing in other shoes, as it were. But yeah, so you need to think about, do those examples work? And he's also trying to get us to, you know, to just break through our self-centeredness and our focus on ourselves. That's what he's trying to do, and kind of empathise with others and understand that others experience pain just as we experience pain. So if I experience pain and someone else experiences pain, there's pain, why don't I just do something about the pain? So there's that wonderful thing about the cloud of suffering, isn't there? It's just a cloud of suffering. Doesn't matter whose suffering it is. It's, in a way, it's unowned, as it were. It's owned by everybody, and it's unowned. And it, all you need to know is that it hurts. It hurts you, hurts somebody else. You work to remove that cloud of suffering and turn it into a cloud of joy, or in the text, there's an ocean of joy. So, you know, work, empathy, compassion, is the main work here, isn't it? And just kind of, what's that quote from Shelley about, you know, you know, the one about love, having to go out of yourself in order to empathise with other beings. You know, that's what we're trying to do, isn't it? In the Metta Bhavana, in the Karuna Bhavana, in the Tonglen, just trying to just not see things all the time from the perspective of me. Now I'm central in my own universe and everything revolves around me. I mean, it's not easy to do that because it's so strong, isn't it? And we, in some ways, we've needed to do that for protection and for all kinds of reasons. But so we're trying to go beyond that and kind of really empathise, really experience the interdependence, the sameness of all beings. All beings are the same. We all suffer pain. You know, as it says in the Bodhicitta practice, what a tragedy. So in the end, I think Bhante sums this whole chapter up by saying, well, in a way, you're just trying to be more objective, as it were. In a way, you're trying to be more emotional and more compassionate, more empathic. But in a way, you're trying to be more objective about not just focusing on yourself as a subject, but seeing that all beings suffer. You know, he somewhere says that metta is objective love, doesn't he? More objective, less selfish, more imaginative, more empathic, more aware and more sensitive. So these chapters are very long, can't go into it in great detail, but at the end of that he says, doesn't he, therefore in order to dispel the obscurations I shall withdraw my mind from mistaken ways and constantly place it in equipoise upon the perfect object. Now there's a, you know, you need to read the introduction in the Crosby Skilton text because, you know, they discuss... you know, that he's using different kinds of meditation methods. It's he's using Chittamatra Yogacara methods and he's working up to the Madhya Maka as expressed in the wisdom chapter. So read that and think about it. There's different ways of looking at this chapter and how it's constructed. So that will do.